Ragtime to Rock and Roll. In the first program of the series, Kenneth Moore set the musical scene in Britain and America at the moment the new century began, examining the songs that were being sung and played in theatres, clubs, pubs, drawing rooms, and concert halls on both sides of the Atlantic, and describing what, musically, as well as historically speaking, was the dawn of a new age.
The face of popular music is forever changing, and sometimes the factors that alter its expression go unnoticed at the time. For instance, if we trace the story of popular music in Britain and America since the start of the 20th century, we find that the most important single sound in the United States was not Stephen Foster, or the Belle of New York, or tear-jerking ballads, or rousing marches, but the sound that wafted out of the windows of brothels from Chicago to New Orleans. Piano roll was made in 1902, and the hands manipulating it belonged to a Negro called Scott Joplin, the father of ragtime. And, being a comparatively well-trained musician, Joplin might have seen something in the well-disciplined measures of the sort of song the British were singing at the turn of the new century. Well, the Queen in that song, of course, was Victoria. And to the British, as the 20th century began, it seemed as though she'd been sitting on that throne forever. For more than 60 years, she presided over the largest, richest, strongest empire in history, resolutely refusing to be amused. And now, amazingly, the new century found itself still a Victorian century, still asking that most Victorian of all questions, and still giving the most Victorian of all answers. Have you brought your music? Of course I have. Well, what music would it be, and played on what instruments? In Britain in 1900, there were tens of thousands of pianos, to say nothing of the harmoniums, the organs, the flutes, the tambourines, the violins and triangles, dare one say eternal triangles. Out in the hall stands a harp, looming like a gloomy portent of the life to come. That is, until the timorous Miss Phipps can be persuaded to play it. You just try stopping her. And surely Captain Blenkinsop, the one with the Dundreary whiskers, might be tempted to sing one of the hilariously comic songs of the day.
I'm a broken-hearted milkman, and in grief I may ride, all through keeping of the company of a certain young maid. What lived on board wages, be asked to keep clean, in a fine gentleman's residence, a pack of Paddington green. She was beautiful as a butterfly, and as proud as a queen, was pretty little Polly Perkins of Paddington green. When I'd roll up in the mornings and shout milk below, at the sound of me milk and her fair face she'd show, with a laugh upon her countenance and a smile in her eye. If I thought that she'd love me, I'd lay down to die. She was beautiful as a butterfly and as proud as a queen, was pretty little Polly Perkins of Paddington Green. When I asked her for to marry me, she says, oh, what's stuck? And asked me to drop it, cause she'd had quite enough of me nonsense. At the same time, I'd been very kind, but for marriage with a milkman, she didn't feel inclined. She was beautiful as a butterfly and as proud as a queen, what pretty little Polly Perkins of Paddington Green. And now in 6 months she was married, this hard-hearted girl, and it was not a baronet, and it was not a hoe, not even a viscount, was a shade or two us, was the bandy-legged conductor of a tarpany bus. She was beautiful as a butterfly, as proud as a queen, was pretty little Polly Perkins of Paddington Green.
Bless her little heart. And just to lend the gathering a little cultural weight, as it were, one of those Wagnerian ladies whose breasts had long ago congealed into bosom, would surely render that hero, so beloved of our beloved queen, the dear departed Lord Tennyson.
Come into the garden, Maud, for the black-backed night has flown. Come into the garden, Maud, I am here at the gate alone. I am here at the gate alone, and the woodbine spices are wafted abroad, and the musk of the roses blown, for a breeze of morning moon, and the planet of love is on high, beginning to paint in the light that she loves, on the bed of daffodil sky. In the light of the sun she loves, to faint in the light and to die. Come, come, come into the garden, Maud, for the black bat night has flown. Come into the garden, Maud, alone.
And then there were regional specialities, especially in the north of England.
Hallelujah, 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 hallelujah.
suppose in 1900 you were tone-deaf and voiceless. Well, if you had the price of a ticket, you might attend a concert or recital in one of those halls which a young critic called Bernard Shaw described as being 185 degrees in the draught. Shaw was typically Victorian in that his entire family played musical instruments and sang, especially his Uncle William, who specialised in something called the Offutt Lied. Alas, such abandoned music turned Uncle William's brain. And when he insisted on taking his boots off so that he could fly more easily to heaven, he had to be removed to the local asylum where he perished of heart failure. But while anachronisms like Shaw's Uncle William and his Offutt Lied disappeared from British musical life, other ways of music making proved more durable. The sound of music awaited you everywhere, even in the streets, especially in the streets. You can get some idea of how common that sound was from the fact that in 1895 there were 222 brass band competitions held in England alone. An even more common musical effect was the infinitely pathetic strain of something which a writer once described as the spirits of dead Londoners making music. More popular even than brass bands or German bands or hurdy-gurdies or barrel organs was the music you made yourself in the local pub, where a chap could join in and nobody ever noticed if he had a voice like a rusty fretsaw. Songs like that were part of the folklore of late Victorian England. Just as today young folk carry transistors and cassettes, so the shop girls and bank clerks of 75 years ago were never far away from a squeeze box or a banjo. Remember that moment in Three Men in a Boat, when our heroes settle back after supper on the damp cushions of their little boat and endure the ordeal of George giving them a little song.
She's my lady love, she is my dove, my baby love. She's no girl for setting down to dream. She's the only queen Laguna knows. I know she likes me, I know she likes me, because she says so. She is the lily of Laguna. She is my lily and my rose.
is my love, my baby love. She's no gal for setting out a dream. She's the only queen the moon ever holds. I know she likes me. I know she likes me because she says so. She is the lily of Laguna. She is my lily and my rose.
The songwriter used to go to an artist and say, I've got an idea for a song, you see. And then he'd tell him the idea. And then he'd probably have one chorus written. And if it interested them, they say, oh, I like that. Yeah, finish it. They have to give them a few bob to finish the song. And you bring it back, and then they'd take a write of it, you see. You might buy it outright. If he was a mug, they could buy it outright. But if he wasn't, they would have a write, a performing write of it, a sole performing write. And then, of course, the music hall artists used to work these numbers, work them to get everything out of them. Then the publishers used to come in and publish the number. But they never published a number while it was still very popular. They waited till they worked it out and got known by it, and then the publisher would publish it.
At the period that Stanley Holloway was talking of, the music hall was at its zenith, wallowing in a golden age of incredible artistic richness. Music hall was the great working class art form, not only because the working classes supported it, but because the working classes also supplied the art. The stars, the writers, the composers, even the impresarios were sons and daughters of mean streets. So not surprisingly, the songs of the music hall dealt with the stings of everyday life. Well, what were those stings? Too many kids, for one thing.
Don't have any more, Mrs. Moore. Mrs. Moore, please don't have any more. The more you have, the more you'll want. They say I'm enough. He's as good as a feast any day. If you add any more, Mrs. Moore, you'll have to take the house next door. They're all right when they're here, but take my advice, oh dear. Don't have any more, Mrs. Moore.
Another very serious problem was being poor, but having expensive tastes.
I'm first. Perhaps you've heard of me first. You've had word of me plodding along, happy and strong, living on plates of fresh air. I thrill up in fashion, and when I am feeling depressed, I shave from my cuff all the whiskers and fluff, stick my hat on and toddle up with. I'm Burlington Percy. I rise at 10:30, then saunter along like a swan. I walk down the Strand with my gloves on my hands, then I walk down again with them on. I'm all airs and graces, collect easy paces. So long without food, I forgot where my place is. I'm first. First, I haven't a shirt, but my people are well off, you know. Nearly everyone knows me from Smith's Lord Road. I'm Burlington Bertie Flumbo.
One way out for a bloke like Bertie, of course, would be to marry for money. Although the music hall always managed to include also a sly sexual double entendre.
People say Susanna's got money, a nice long stocking, and it's right, I know.
And if you never found a girl with a well-filled stocking, you might well end up as one of the thousands of London's destitute, sleeping in the streets.
I live in Trafalgar Square with four lions to guard me. Fountains and statues all over the place, and the metropole staring me right in the face. I'll own it's a trifle drafty, but I look at it this way, you see. If it's good enough for Nelson, it's quite good enough for me. The beds ain't as soft as they might be, still the temperature's never too high.
And it's nice to see swells who are passing look on you with envious eye. And then when you wake in the morning, just fancy how nice it must be to have a good walk for your breakfast, and the same for your dinner and tea. There's many a swell up in Park Lane tonight who'd be glad if he only had my appetite. I live in Trafalgar Square with four lions to guard me. Fountains and statues all over the place, and the metropole staring me right in the face. I own it's a trifle drafty, but I look at it this way, you see. If it's good enough for Nelson, it's quite good enough for me.
Even the grimmest reality of all, the workhouse, was put to words and music by the music hall, although later generations often missed the illusion. The real point of this next song is that when a couple went to the workhouse, he had to go to one building and she had to go in a different one. The Victorian word for it was charity.
I've got a pal, she's a regular out and out. She's a good dear old gal, and I'll tell you all about her. It's many years since first we met. Her hair was then as black as jet. It's whiter now, but she don't fret. Don't my old gal. We've been together now for 40 years, and it don't seem a day too much, for there ain't a lady living in the land as I'd swap for me dear old Dutch. There ain't a lady living in the land as I'd swap for me dear old Dutch.
Of course, not all the great songs of the music hall were socially conscious, and even the most lugubrious of them had vitality, so that when you went to see a really great music hall artist, you never forgot it, especially if, like Sir Compton Mackenzie, you never forgot anything.
Mary Lloyd was wearing, and I can see it now, a sort of creamy golden dress with a cloud of silk amber underclothes. For besides singing, she was dancing. Dararabundia was one of the first of the high-kicking songs. It became the rage, although we were all rather inclined to be a little shocked about this high-kicking. In fact, it was considered a dazzling and daring thing to do. Though, really, in that cloud of amber underclothes, there was hardly any leg distinguishable at all above the knee. Indeed, it was a highly respectable performance. Still, the fact remains that she was pulling up her skirt. And I, who had been brought up in a severe Victorian tradition, was rather shaken by the freedom with which she was kicking her legs about, particularly as my grim old nurse was present. So I turned round to Harriet Payne, who was standing behind us in the shadows at the back of the box, and said, "She's showing her drawers." Which really was a frightful thing, even for a little girl of six to do. Today, it's anybody's joke. But even to the First World War, I couldn't have told that story in public.
And every little moment has a meaning of its own. Every little moment tells a tale. When she walks in dainty hobble, at the back around the hill, there's a kind of wibble wobble, and she glides like this. Then the John is following her trail. But when she turns her head like so, something's doing, don't you know? Every little movement tells a tale. Could be Maudie would go for her dip every day. Maudie had an eye for the boys, oh my, and it happened that already was passing that way. When already saw her, he fell in quite a trance. He too was going bathing, for he now held a chance. She didn't smile or frown, just threw her peg more down, then shyly shrugged her shoulders with a glance. And every little movement movement has a meaning of its own. Every little movement tells a tale. When she dashed into the ocean, Freddy kept close by. For to know her either notion, Morty tried to swim. Oh, I'm half dead already if you fail. And in less than half a wink, Morty dear commenced to sink. Every little movement tells a tale.
If Murray Lloyd made sauciness an art form, then the great Cockney artist Gus Elan made pessimism a science. One critic wrote of him, "He too much resembles real life to be wholly pleasurable." An opinion endorsed by Sir Max Beerbohm. Although Sir Max wasn't complaining, Gus Elan, on the other hand, was always complaining.
Gus Elan defied the conventions only by the extreme, the almost desperate glumness of his demeanour, and the bitterness of what he had to say. On a stage where cheeriness against all odds was ever the resounding keynote. Immensely acrid was the spirit of his "I dunno where he are," and of his "Well, it's a great big shame.
I've lost my pal, he's the best in all the town, but don't you think him dead because he ain't. But since he's wed, he has had to knuckle down. It's enough to whet the temper of a shine. He's a brewer's driving with a leg of mutton fist and as strong as a bullock or an horse. Yet in her hands, he's like a little kid. Oh, I wish that I could give him a divorce. Well, it's a great big shame, and if she belonged to me, I'd let her know who's who. And nagging at a fella what is 6 foot 3, and her only 5 foot 2. Hadn't been married not a month nor more, when underneath her thumb goes Jim. How, oh, isn't it a pity as the likes of her could cut up and the likes of him? Now Jim was clerk, he could sing a decent song, and at scrapping he had won some great renown. Well, it took 2 coppers for to make him move along, and another 6 old the fella down. But today when I axes would he come and have some beer, to the doorstep on tiptoe he arrived. I guess, says he, "Don't shout, poor silly, I've got to clean the windows and the knives. Well, it's a great big shame, and if she belonged to me, oh, I'd let her know who's who. And nagging at a fellow what is 6 foot 3, and her only 4 foot 2. Hadn't been married not a month nor more, when underneath her thumb goes Jim. How, oh, isn't it a pity as the likes of her should pass upon the likes of him?"
Elan, of course, was a pessimist of genius, who began his career on the wrong side of the footlights selling chocolates. And so, as a schoolboy in Manchester, did Sir Neville Cardus.
They were called Bovril chocolates. Penny a bar. And I saw Eugene Stratton in a pantomime, Robinson Crusoe or something, and he sang the "I may be crazy, but I love you." An escaped Negro making love to his girl. And then he sang the "Leave Laguna" and danced to it. And his dancing was so light-footed, I'd never seen anything quite like it. Only once when Pavlova came to the Free Trade Hall, Manchester. And I always think that the light-footedness on the stage, Eugene Stratton and Pavlova. And now, in these pantomimes, they used to go twice daily, you know, 2 o'clock and 7. It was hard work for these people, these comedians. And then there was a girl in this pantomime named Daisy Jerome, and I was then about 16 or so, and I fell in love with her. Never spoke to her, of course, in my life, but in those days they used to have picture postcards. So I got a picture postcard of Daisy Jerome, whom I could see every day on the stage, and I wore it always next to my heart. And one day I was in the theatre rather before it, a matinee before it began, and through the dress circle came Eugene Stratton with Daisy Jerome and said, "Hello, sonny." And nothing in my life has ever thrilled me so much as Eugene Stratton in the company of this beautiful musical comedy star said, "Hello, sonny."
Maluma, I've got to go. So soon there's been some trouble and they mean to settle someone. Maluma, that is I know. This cone, I ain't got time to wait too long for you. There's a lot of them are after me and they can shoot, you see. But I can't go without some little conversation, 'cause I risk so much in this ride to you, that you might say just one little kind goodbye. Now I may be crazy, but I love you. I'll risk a dare on, I've got the care on. I may be shady, but I love you. So won't you come right here and say goodbye? Because you may not see me anymore.
But all these songs about families that were too large and incomes that were too small, what was their place in the social scheme? The best answer was probably given by that full-time dilettante, that Irishman who made a profession out of being an amateur, George Moore. He said, "The music hall is a protest against the wearisome stories concerning wills and misers. It's a protest against the immense drawing-room sets, the rich hangings, the velvet sofas. It's a protest against the villa, the circulating library, and the club." Well, where could you find all these libraries and villas and velvet sofas? The answer was in musical comedy. By 1900, the satire of Gilbert and Sullivan had been largely superseded by the saccharine of the more escapist world of the musical. Sullivan died as the century was born, but Gilbert remained very much alive, a source of inspiration to the younger school of lyric writers, who revered him so much that sometimes they revered him too much, as P.G. Woodhouse testifies.
I've taken the Lancet, his place, Harrow Weald, and he was a great raconteur, and he started to tell this very long story that was one of those stories where you make it as dull as possible up to the punchline, when everybody collapses and roars with laughter. And there's a pause before the punchline. And I thought the story was over. And I thought, it didn't seem a bit funny to me. But I thought it must be funny because it was Gilbert. And I roared with laughter. Gave me the dirtiest look. I never saw anybody look so furious.
Somebody else besides P.G. Woodhouse who was spoiling the joke for Gilbert was an impresario called George Edwards, who evolved the type of show we remember today as a kind of mad, perfumed whirl of romantic melody, pink chiffon, small plots and large hats, and of course the hourglass figures of girls like Edward's famous leading lady, Ruby Miller.
He was very big, very tall man, wide shoulders, blonde hair, parted in the middle, they all wore it with waves on either side, a kitchen and moustache, and very, very blue, kindly eyes, but very, very keen. He saw through everything. He ran it perfectly. And he ran the Vaudeville with Flora Dora and had that wonderful sextet, Tell Me Pretty Maiden. That was in it. And all those musical comedies in both theatres. And Daisy's he ran as well, but chiefly sort of semi-operette. In fact, they were known as the Virgins, and we were known as the Girls. That was the difference. We got all the measures and stage door dummies. They filled the stalls. We actually filled the stalls. We saw nothing but them. At the Gaiety, I think Moonstruck was chiefly the favourite. That was the favourite of all of us. You see, they were lighter songs of Christmas. Delia and If I Had Ya Here were lighter songs. But musically, we loved Moonstruck.
The world of Moonstruck and Lionel Monckton was essentially an escape world, but the odd thing about it is that sometimes reality was crazy enough to follow its hints. The musical comedy scene was one where Burke's English peerage hung around the stage door in the hope that some kind lady would offer them a slipper full of champagne. At least that's the way the legend goes. The funny thing is, sometimes the legend turned out to be true.
In this case of a grenadier, it was a wonderful party, oh, something you never see these days. A private room at a Marmon's, and a few of the girls, about half a dozen. Then all his entourage, which were all great people, at the table. And his white guards served us. And they served meat on flaming swords. Most extraordinary. And the whole long table was set with pale blue satin, covered in lace, real lace, and gold plate. Everywhere. And Luigi, he was the head waiter there, he said, "Please, Miss Miller, His Imperial Highness would like the loan of one of your slippers." I thought, well, it won't fit him. I could have thought it was an old Russian custom or something. So fortunately, they were new. Whenever we had anything special to go to, George Edwards always gave us a completely new regout. I had a wonderful pale green dress made of Lucille, the great dressmaker. I had pale green shoes. We matched all those accessories to our dresses. We never wore what we do today, half things. But they were green stockings, green satin shoes, and they were gloves up to here, dyed green. Everything green. Perfect. And then I took the slipper off, gave it to Luigi, and he took it to the Grand Duke. And the Grand Duke, I wonder what he was going to do. Wanted some champagne, he brought the Magnum, and he poured it in the slipper. And he drank it from the back of the heel. When he finished, he sent it back to me and bowed really low. He said, "Thank you, madam, for the loan of your slipper." "Well, it's a very charming gesture," I said to him. "Your Imperial Highness," but I said, "you left my shoe a little damp." A few days later, I went into my flat after lunch, and wherever I looked, there were shoe boxes. He sent me 60 pairs in every colour and every shape imaginable, and a little note saying, "That was the best champagne I ever drank. Thank you so much for the loan of your supper."
Yip, I am, I am, I am. I don't care what becomes of me when he plays me that sweet melody. Yip. My heart wants to shout hooray. Sing of joy, sing of bliss, home was never like this. Yip, I am, I am.
Those were the good old days when you could get half a quart of gin at Tupper's Barton and Two Out, half a quart of whiskey Threepence, half a quart of rum Tupper's Halfpenny, and a pint of ale. The cups. Give me a good old-fashioned pound. No salute for me. I don't want to pay for pictures on the wall. I want a decent drop of beer, that's all. I don't want no coffee on the floor. Give me the value in the ground and the welcome kind. You'll always find in a good old-fashioned pound.
There, in the contrast between the sugary harmonies of Ruritania and realities of Edwardian life, we can begin to see why so many people preferred the candors of the music hall, why an intellectual like Ford Madox Ford actually did the editing of his literary magazine, The English Review, from a box at the Shepherd's Bush Empire, why G.K. Chesterton observed in the Illustrated London News, "We have reached so high and rarefied a condition of humbug that the most serious things we have left are the comic songs." And not even the music hall was above a bit of sentimentalizing. Those soldiers of the Queen that everyone sang about so proudly were getting a shilling a day. As for the typical George Edwards musical comedy, where shop girls posed as duchesses and duchesses as shop girls, perhaps it all sounds a shade too naive to us, a world of sugary harmonies, a soft-scented world of gaiety and certitude. Perhaps not so much of the gaiety and certitude if you were up in the gallery, but nevertheless, a world so appealing to us, and it still seems to beckon.
I remember asking the barmaid at the end of the Empire Promenade for some cigarettes, and her saying to me, "Which do you want, dear, Turks or virgins?" Last today, who would ask which you wanted? She would assume you wanted virgins.
Well, I think the showgirls, we got about £10 a week, because we were next to the prisoners. The chorus girls got about 35 bob or 25 bob or something like that. We all had to be individuals. We all had to have minds. We had to be witty. That's for the men people. They wanted to hear us say wonderful things, laugh their heads off at supper. You see, that was it. We had to have minds, not just bodies.
Clearly in the popular music world of the New Age, there were class distinctions in taste, in tickets, in theatres, even in interpretation. Sir Neville Cardus, with a position that might have pleased Karl Marx, has defined the various boundaries.
There was the upper class. There was the aristocracy of light music, which I think is Johann Strauss. Then you have Sullivan in the upper middle class. And then you have Carroll and Monckton in the middle class, and then you have grading down, and Souza going right down, and it seemed to be more graded than it is now.